himself up and over the wall, grabbing at handholds along pipes and stained sills, kicking at the surface for support. He heard the stormtroopers behind him counting bodies and hurried on, chest flat against the rooftop. Less than an hour later, he was on a shuttle departing the Ring of Caffrine. His face and beard were dripping where he'd wiped them with a cold sponge in the sanitation station. Not just to hide the sweat on his brow, but to shock himself back into focus. He had a lot to occupy his mind, and farther to go before he could transmit it to Draven and Alliance Intelligence. He closed his eyes and sorted the cards in his hand. Jeddah, the Pilgrim Moon, a wasteland world intimately linked to a vast Imperial project only visible through its ripple effects. The Kyber Crystals, Jeddah's only natural resource of any value. The Empire had been shipping crystals off-world, their ultimate destination unknown. A defecting pilot carrying a message to Saw Gerrera. Possibly trustworthy, possibly not. Saw Gerrera. Nominally part of the rebellion. In practice, not so easily categorized. Galen Erso. The legendary scientist connected again to the Imperial megaproject whose existence the Alliance could only speculate about. The man whose message the pilot supposedly carried. And the weapon. The Planet Killer. The galaxy's nightmare. Designed and built and polished to shine by Erso and his cronies. It was more than Cassian had hoped to bring back from this mission. A treasure hoard of facts and speculation and possible connections. Enough to keep the analysts busy for weeks or months or years. If he was lucky, it would even be enough to keep him from replaying over and over in his head on the long shuttle ride to safety. The last dying groan of the man he'd murdered. Bodhi Rook had only ever doubted himself, and today was no exception. His captors hadn't hurt him. Threatened him, yes. Refused him food and water and left him with a headache that seemed to squeeze his skull tight around his swollen brain, yes. But they treated him more like an object than a man. They rarely spoke as they dragged him across the frigid Jeddah desert, grasping him by the arms and marching at a pace that he, insulated by the Imperial flight suit he wore under a loose caftan, couldn't quite match. His soles touched sand twice for every three steps his captors took. And so every three steps he flew, and their grip became painfully tight. He could survive this, he told himself. He'd chosen right, found the right people. And when he delivered his message, they would all understand. They would accept him as a good man, a brave man. He could only hope that was all true. How much farther? He asked. His captors stayed close around him, so close he couldn't see much of the wasteland. Just pale and freezing sun, low mountains that form the borders of the valley, and the occasional crumbling monolith of one of Jeddah's great statues. A stern humanoid head with lips worn smooth over millennia, or a pair of broken legs embedded in the cracked and rusty valley floor. When the wind rose, loose wisps of long dark hair drifted before his eyes.
I know you're being careful, he said, struggling to sound reasonable. I know that's smart. You think I could be a spy, and spies have to be a worry for people like you. Don't make them think about spies.
He told himself that, even as another part of his brain assured him, hide nothing. Only honesty will save you.
He fought to regain his train of thought.
But,
he spat air through dry lips.
You also have to give me a chance. Not for my sake, but for yours. I want to help you.
His captors, 5 revolutionaries in ragged local attire, each armed with an illegal blaster rifle, yanked him hard, and he scrabbled over the dust. No one met his gaze. Instead, scarred, unwashed faces watched Bodhi's bound hands or the endless desert.
An interminable time passed before he spoke again.
Do you have a family?
He asked a towering man with a blade half concealed in his boot. For his troubles, he got the briefest of glances.
I have a family,
Bodhi said, though it was only somewhat true. The revolutionaries began to spread apart, wordlessly changing formation to put Bodhi at the center of a broad semicircle. With his newly expanded field of vision, Bodhi now saw a second group standing ahead of them in the wastes, small dark figures on a bright horizon.
Is that him?
Bodhi asked, and received no reply. The semicircle closed the distance to the second band. The newcomers resembled Bodhi's captors, but carried their ordnance more conspicuously. A white-furred Jigorin hoisted a rotary cannon, while the humans wore bandoliers and detonator belts. At the fore of the newcomers was a Tognath, a lanky figure dressed in dark leathers, whose pale, skull-like head was set in the vice grip of a mechanical respirator. The Tognath turned his sockets onto Bodhi and said, in a thickly accented dialect,
It's the pilot. Look alive.
The Tognath gestured once, and the two bands merged with a swift and soldierly precision. Bodhi flinched under the Jigorin's glower and felt a flush of shame. Non-humans hadn't made him nervous before he'd signed on with the Empire. He made himself focus.
Okay, so you're Saul Guerrera?
He asked, more in hope than genuine belief. Someone snickered. The Tognath examined Bodhi with an expression that might have been disdain.
No?
Bodhi shook his head.
Okay, we're just wasting time that we don't have. I need to speak to Saul Guerrera. I keep telling them.
He lifted a shoulder at one of his original captors.
Before it's too late.
He thought he heard another snicker. It might have been the wind playing on sand, but it was enough to raise his ire.
They need you. You need to make them understand. We need to get to Jeddah City. We're out here in the middle of nowhere.
His voice rose to a shout thick with frustration.
What part of urgent message do you guys not understand?
He saw the shadow above him, then felt coarse cloth drag over his hair, catch on the goggles perched on his forehead, and slide tight against his nose, mustache, and beard. He saw the glow of the sun through the stitching of the sack over his head.
Hey!
He said, trying not to bite the fabric.
Hey! We're all on the same side, if you just see past the uniform for a minute. You always talk, his mother had said, but you say so little. Learn to listen, Bodhi Rook.
Talking was all he could do now.
I've got to speak to Saul Guerrera, he cried.
He was pleading as one set of hands released his arms and new hands, the terribly strong hands of the Jigorin, took their place.
You know what? Just tell him. Tell him what I told you, and then he'll want to speak to me.
I gave up everything to come here.
I'm here to help.
Someone pulled the sack tight around his neck. It scraped at his throat when he breathed. Bodhi Rook thought about the reason he'd come back to Jeddah and found himself hating Galen Erso. Jin had been at the Empire's mercy before. Sometimes she'd even deserved her troubles. She couldn't blame some petty dictator for ordering her dragged off the street and slammed into holding when she really, truly was planning to blow up his ship and steal his guns. She'd had rifles pointed at her, felt stun prods delivered jolts to her spine, and generally suffered the worst a stormtrooper was authorized to deal out. What made her circumstances different now was that, for the first time, Jin had no escape route. No partners outside the prison walls waiting to bust down the doors. No inn with a greedy security officer she could promise, lying or not, to pay off. Not even a knife she could hide where the guards wouldn't find it. She'd run out of friends. She'd come to Obani labor camp alone. She expected to die there that way, and, very likely, it wouldn't take long at all. She opened her eyes, flinched away her thoughts as a drop of filthy water smacked into her forehead, and took a circuitous route down the side of her nose. She smeared it away with her palm and glanced about her cell, as if it might have changed since lights out. But there was no gap in the wall, no blaster tucked discreetly beside her slab. The blanket-draped lump of her cellmate moaned and wheezed, loud enough to wake Jin, even if she did manage to sleep. She waited for the stormtrooper on patrol to pass her door, counted to five, then slid to her feet and crept to the bars. Outside was an endless march of more cell doors, more prisoners sleeping, or in a few cases, feeding their own private demons, clawing their arms or sketching invisible mandalas on the floor. Wobani didn't care about treatment or rehabilitation any more than it did about punishment. Order and obedience were the priority. Everything else was left to rot.
Bad dreams.
The moaning and wheezing had stopped. The voice sounded like claws on slate. Not really, Jin said.
Then you should not be up,
her cellmate huffed, the tentacles protruding from her pinched worm-like face, writhed in irritation. The woman called herself Nail. The other prisoners at Wobani called her Kennel, for the parasite she hosted in the filthy cloth jacket that half covered her leathery chest. Only the guards called her by her real name, which, along with her species and actual gender, Jin hadn't bothered to learn. They both fell silent as the patrol came around again. Jin returned to the slab that served as her bed, considered rising a second time solely to irritate Kennel, then decided against it. If she was going to pick a fight, better to be awake enough to enjoy it.
Do you want a warning?
Kennel asked.
Before I do it?
Not really, Jin repeated. Kennel grunted and rolled from one side to the other.
I will give you one anyway. Next work crew we are on together. I will kill you then.
Jin laughed breathily and without humor.
Who's going to keep you company?
I like a quiet cell,
Kennel said.
What if I kill you first?
Jin asked.
Then I hope you like a quiet cell, Liana Halleck.
Liana Halleck. Not Jin's favorite name, but probably her last. She twisted her lips into a smile that her cellmate wouldn't see.
Were you always like this?
She asked after the stormtrooper had passed by.
Before Wobani, back to when you were a kid.
Yes,
Kennel replied.
Me too,
Jin said. Neither of them spoke again. Jin lay on her slab and didn't sleep, and toyed with the necklace tucked under her shirt. The crystal she'd managed to keep, smuggled into the prison when she should have been worried about weapons or a comlink. She didn't think much about her would-be murderer, knowing that if Kennel didn't kill her, something else would. No one survived Wobani for long. Jin was supposed to serve 20 years. But anything more than 5 was a death sentence. All she could do was try to pick the most interesting end possible. The next morning, the stormtroopers gathered up the war crews, selecting prisoners at random. Supposedly at random, though everyone knew the guards had favorites for their day on the farms. Jin preferred work to sitting in her cell. She handled strained and quivering muscles better than agonizing boredom. And she'd almost given up hope when a guard waved a rifle at her cell door. A short while later, she and Kennel were chained by the arms to a bench in the back of a rusting turbo tank, bouncing and rocking with 3 other convicts as a trio of stormtroopers looked on from the front. None of the prisoners looked at one another. Jin took that as a good sign. If Kennel was planning to kill her, at least she didn't have allies. The transport stopped so suddenly that Jin whipped forward, the metal of her shackles raking the flesh of her wrists. There was shouting outside. Curiosity wormed its way into Jin's brain. They'd been in transit too little time to be at the farms. The other prisoners shifted restively, glancing at the stormtroopers and the forward door.
"Nobody moves!"
A trooper snapped. His 2 partners had their weapons up. All 3 turned to face front. Jin heard the dull thunk of something metallic and a faint, high-pitched whine. One of the other prisoners was looking up now, grinning with excitement like he'd figured it all out. Then, the front of the transport exploded. The roar of the detonating grenade, it had to be a grenade, Jin knew the noise too well, made her ears throb and turned the screams and shouts and blaster shots that followed into a tinny, incomprehensible buzz. Smoke carrying the odor of ash and burning circuits flooded the rear compartment, stinging Jin's eyes and nostrils. She tried to follow what was happening, watch the movements of the stormtroopers, but it hurt to look and she had to blink away grit. She kept her gaze on the floor. In her peripheral vision, she saw the stormtroopers die one by one, felled by a barrage of particle bolts that burned through their armor and sparked against the transport walls.
"Halleck!"
a muffled voice called, barely audible above the ringing in her ears. Jin lifted her chin with a jolt and turned toward the front of the turbo tank. 3 armed figures in battle-stained attire picked their way among the bodies. They wore no insignia, but she knew them by their movements, by their uniformity of manner and their scowls. They were professionals. Soldiers. They weren't with the Empire. That made them rebels. They'd found her. She couldn't stop the thought. It leapt into her head, demanded that she fight, that she run. But it made no sense. Why would they even be looking for her? Maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe they were after a different prisoner and she'd misheard.
"Liana Halleck!"
The leader, a man so thoroughly covered in gear that his exposed face seemed out of place among the cloth and leather, called again. Jin slowly lowered her gaze to the chains around her wrists. Her hands were shaking. She gripped her seat to make them stop.
"Her!"
another rebel said, and gestured in Jin's direction. Her deafness was abating. She waited, half expecting a blaster bolt to the head. She wondered how it would feel. People died fast from blaster bolts. She'd seen it enough. She didn't think it would hurt much.
"You want to get out of here?"
the rebel leader asked. His tone was neutral, guarded, as if he was as cautious of Jin as Jin was of him. Jin tried to imagine what had brought the rebels to her. Had Saw decided to bring her back? Had one of his people decided she knew too much? She nodded at the man, lacking any better option. One of the rebel grunts fumbled with her shackles, finally unlocking them with a key from a stormtrooper's corpse. Jin snapped upright, dizzy from the smoke and the blood rushing to her head, but determined not to show it. Her rescuer started to say something when from the other side of the transport, a prisoner called,
"Hey! What about me?"
The rebel standing over her turned away. Jin recognized it as an opening. She was halfway across the transport floor in a second, her foot driving firmly into the leader's soft gut to slam him against the wall. Momentum kept Jin upright as she spun toward a second body closing in. She swung a fist, landed a solid blow to the newcomer's face, felt his teeth through his cheek. She stumbled forward, still lightheaded, and grabbed the first weapon she could find among the farming tools stored nearby. A shovel, solid and long enough to give her reach. She'd seen the damage a shovel could do in a prisoner's hands. She let the shovel's weight carry her through her first swing, gave a solid fleshy smack to the leader as the man bounced back from where she kicked him into the wall. She swung again to strike the rebel who'd unshackled her as he came up from behind. Jin saw a clear path to the front of the transport and dashed for the twisted and broken doors. The world was a blur, but she was out, feet striking the gravel trail. She could find a way off Wobani, forge new Scandocks, retire Lyanna Halleck and start over yet again. Pick whatever name she wanted, one the Empire wouldn't care about and the Rebel Alliance would never find.
"You are being rescued,"
a voice said. It was electronically distorted, but too high-pitched to be a stormtrooper. A cold metal hand snagged her collar, hoisting Jin until she was wriggling half a meter in the air. Before her towered the spindly chassis of a sunlit security droid, black as night, save for the Imperial insignia on its shoulder plates and the dead white bulbs of its eyes.
"Congratulations."
The droid flicked its arm and tossed her to the ground. Pain flashed up Jin's spine, crashed through her skull. Tilting her head back, she saw an angry, bloody-mouthed rebel pointing a rifle at her chest.
"Damn Saw Gerrera, anyway. Damn the whole Rebel Alliance."
Chapter 2. Somewhere inside Jin's brain there was a cave sealed shut by a heavy metal hatch. The cave wasn't for her protection. Instead, it was where she locked away the things she was done with, but couldn't altogether forget. The rebellion. Saw Gerrera. People and places buried in the dark for so long that she barely recognized their names as more than cruel, hurtful impulses. She loathed the cave and everything inside it. Everyone who knew about it. It wasn't real, of course, though she described it to someone once, someone she trusted, and admitted what the image meant to her. She'd immediately regretted it, and sworn to keep it hidden forever after. Now the grenade that had ruined the prisoner transport had exposed the hatch, blasted away the concealing soil, put it in open view of Jin and the world. On the long, harrowing flight from Wobani, the U-Wing's navigation computer malfunctioned, forcing her rescuers to hail a fleet of rebellion fighters for help. Although the X-Wings were meant to defend them, Jin felt herself trapped between the armed rebels surrounding her and the hatch inside her mind. Once again, she had no escape.
A moist film swaddled Jin as she disembarked onto the jungle moon of a red gas giant. Warm breezes carried the aroma of rotting vegetation from the forest floor, masking the subtler stench of mildew. The shadow and shelter of a great stone ziggurat provided only a semblance of relief. Just enough to remind a person how pervasive the heat and humidity and stink really were. It wasn't the most uncomfortable rebel outpost Jin had ever visited. But it was the first she'd seen while under armed guard, or without knowing where she was. Maybe the star system was too obscure to even have a name.
Keep walking.
The man who'd led the raid in Wobani marched Jin down the outdoor tarmac and onto the slick stone floor of the ziggurat's makeshift hangar. The man's name was Roose Scott Melshi. He hadn't bothered to introduce himself, but she'd overheard him talking to the pilot.
"You're still mad, aren't you?"
she said.
"About what?"
"Being hit with a shovel."
Melshi grunted.
"They're waiting,"
he said, and she didn't ask who, because she knew it was what he expected. If it was Saw who was waiting, she knew how to deal with him. They walked together, past pilots in jumpsuits chattering at technicians, past starfighters and freighters and transports sitting in orderly rows. It was more than a mere rebel outpost should have had. Wherever Jin was, it was important. Even without knowing what system they'd arrived in, she suspected she'd seen too much to be allowed to ever regain her freedom. She fantasized about tripping Melshi on the wet stone, smashing his face into the rock, grabbing his weapon, dragging him bodily back to the hangar entrance, and using him as a human shield. The rebels wouldn't let her off-world, but she could escape to the jungle where she would.
What?
Poison herself, trying to live off the local flora? She let Melshi guide her deeper into the ziggurat. A troubling thought came to her. Saw would never let a prisoner see all this. The rebels hadn't built the ziggurat. That much was obvious. But they'd made it their own, strung cables across ancient etchings, and set flashing consoles like offerings on the slabs of altars. Melshi seemed unmoved. Jin recalled her mother's love of history with the faintest of pangs and banished the memory. When they arrived at a chamber deep below the surface, a bunker maybe, fortified to withstand an attack while the ziggurat crumbled above it, Melshi gestured her inside.
"Try what you tried on Wobani,"
he began. She finished for him.
"And I'd better succeed."
The bunker was dimly lit and subdivided by a conference table. Melshi steered Jin to a chair, and she surveyed the faces arrayed against her. Two men, wearing the insignia of rebel generals. One elderly, pale and soft-eyed. The second, a decade or more the first man's junior, wearing a perpetual scowl under hair like rust. A third man, dark-haired, mustached, closer to Jin's age, stood to one side as if unconcerned with the role he'd been assigned in the rebels' drama. He looked at Jin with an expression of dispassionate curiosity. Saw Gerrera was not present.
"You're currently calling yourself..."
The rust-haired general stepped forward, glancing deliberately between Jin and the datapad in his hand.
"Liana Halleck. Is that correct?"
He stood above her as if he could intimidate her. Jin waited.
"Let him try."
"Possession of unsanctioned weapons. Forgery of imperial documents. Aggravated assault. Escape from custody. Resisting arrest."
He lowered the datapad and cocked his head smugly.
Imagine if the Imperial authorities had found out who you really were. Jin Erso. That's your given name, is it not? She flinched. She felt as much as saw the general smile at his petty victory. Nothing about his words surprised her. The rebels wouldn't kidnap Lyanna. But hearing Jin Erso aloud for the first time in years felt like a violation. The general had taken a cutting torch to the hatch in her brain, crudely attempting to burn through the barrier. He kept talking. Jin Erso, daughter of Galen Erso, a known Imperial collaborator in weapons development. She could have struck him once, maybe twice, to stop him from saying Erso, Erso. The mention of Galen sent a black charred crack through the hatch, and she felt her pulse quicken in response. Before Jin could act, however, she saw movement from the bunker's far entrance. A woman in white robes emerged from the shadows, at once tired and steely. Her face was lined and her copper hair impeccably styled, not like a soldier's or a general's at all. The men, nearly in unison, took half a step away as she claimed the head of the table.
"What is this?"
Jin hissed at the newcomer. "It's a chance for you to make a fresh start," the woman said. "We think you might be able to help us." The words were gentle, but her voice was unforgiving. "Who are you?" "You know who she is." The rust-haired general again. A fleck of spittle touched Jin's forehead, but she kept her attention where it was. The woman gestured at the general, and he fell silent. "My name is Mon Mothma," the woman said. "I sit on the Council of Alliance High Command, and I approved your extraction from Orbani."
Mothma, the Alliance Chief of State. That made the ziggurat. Rebel headquarters. The place where decisions were made, where orders were given while people far away died. Why was she here? Where was Saw?
"There's a bounty on your head," Jin said,
because it was better than not speaking. Because she'd spotted a vulnerability she could jab like an unprotected eye. Mon Mothma didn't laugh, but Jin caught her smiling before she gestured to the third man.
"This is Captain Cassian Andor,"
Mothma said.
"Rebel Alliance Intelligence."
Cassian moved toward Jin but feigned a respectful distance. One that would also give him space to maneuver if she lunged. The rust-haired general retreated to the edge of the room with a shake of his head.
"When was the last time you were in contact with your father?"
Cassian asked. Jin didn't flinch this time. A second crack spread through the hatch. Sparks poured from the cutting torch.
15 years ago, she said.
It was a guess, but close enough.
"Any idea where he's been all that time?"
While the general had tried to intimidate, Cassian's tone was casual, and his eyes were keen. As if these were questions he'd ask over dinner to show he was interested in you as a person.
"I like to think he's dead," Jin said. "Makes things easier."
"Makes things easier," Cassian echoed.
"Easier than what?"
"Than him being a tool of the Imperial war machine?"
Despite the baiting, he kept the same casual tone.
"I've never had the luxury of political opinions."
Jin spotted another trace of a smile from Mothma. But Cassian became sterner.
"Really? When was your last contact with Saw Gerrera?"
"Shouldn't you know?"
If Saw wasn't here, if Saw hadn't helped the rebels find her, then what was any of this about?
It's been a long time, she said.
Cassian's warmth was all spent. His keenness was the keenness of an interrogator.
He'd remember you, though, wouldn't he? He might agree to meet you, if you came as a friend.
Jin opened her mouth to argue, to swear, but she said nothing.
She needed time to figure out an approach, time to decide who she was ready to betray to save herself.
We're up against the clock here, girl.
The rust-haired general snarled.
So if there's nothing to talk about, we'll just put you back where we found you.
Fine. The simple answer. The honest one. The one you already know.
I was a child, she said. Saw Gerrera saved my life. He raised me. But I've no idea where he is. I haven't seen him in years. The elderly general nodded as if this confirmed something he had suspected. He exchanged a glance with Mothma, yet Cassian was the one who spoke next.
We know how to find him, Cassian said.
That's not our problem. What we need is someone who gets us through the door without being killed.
Jin fought down a smirk.
You're all rebels, aren't you?
Yes, but Saw Gerrera's an extremist. He's been fighting his own war for quite some time.
Mothma said, We have no choice but to try to mend that broken trust.
So that was it?
Even when Jin had first met Saw, he'd been on the fringes of the rebellion. If he'd parted ways with the Alliance altogether, it meant his course had held steady.
And now the rebels had kidnapped her from the labor camp to use her as a peace offering.
Only that didn't explain everything. She dug her nails into her palms and asked the question she didn't want answered.
What does this have to do with my father?
Mon Mothma gave Cassian a prompting look.
There's an Imperial defector in the holy city of Jeddah, a pilot. He's being held by Saw Gerrera.
Cassian paused, sought Jin's eyes as if to emphasize the gravity of what he said next.
He's claiming the Emperor is creating a weapon with the power to destroy entire planets.
This time, Jin couldn't help but laugh.
That's a terrible lie, she said.
She expected Mon Mothma to offer another wan smile. Instead, the woman looked at Jin for a long while before saying,
I believe it's the truth. I may be wrong, and I pray that I am, but I believe a weapon that murders worlds is the natural culmination of everything the Emperor has done.
You're all crazy, Jin wanted to say, yet she held back.
You're right, though. Mothma continued. If this were just about Saw Gerrera, we would have other approaches.
Cassian resumed, apparently untroubled by the interruption and Jin's mockery.
The pilot, he said, the one Gerrera has in custody.
What about him? Jin asked.
He says he was sent by your father.
The hatch inside Jin's mind shattered like baked clay.
The things inside the cave, damp and soiled by darkness, seeped unwelcome into her brain.
Foreign thoughts spread like stains, obscuring everything else.
My father is alive. My father is a traitor. My father is building a weapon to destroy worlds. My father is a hero. My father is a coward. My father is a bastard. Galen Erso is not my father. Galen Erso didn't raise me.
Her palms were bleeding where she dug in her fingernails. She wiped her hands on her hips, looked around the suddenly vertiginous room, barely heard Mothma say, "We need to stop this weapon before it is finished."
Or the condescending tone of the rust-haired general. Captain Andor's mission is to authenticate the pilot story, and then, if possible, find your father.
It was too much. Too much to think about now. Maybe too much to think about ever.
But the others were watching her. Jin focused on the sensation of her breath, her clammy skin against the metal chair, the awful, stinking, humid air. She forced her mind's eye away from the broken hatch above the cave, forced revulsion and loathing and doubt down like bile. Mon Mothma was speaking again. It would appear Galen Erso is critical to the development of the superweapon. Given the gravity of the situation and your history with Saw, we're hoping that Saw will help us locate your father and return him to the Senate for testimony.
"And if I do it?"
Jin asked. She spat the words out bitterly, though she didn't hear them.
"We'll make sure you go free,"
Mon Mothma said.
It was the best answer Jin could hope for.
She wasn't calm by the time she walked out of the hangar and onto the tarmac, but she was calmer. Her body felt bruised and sore like the morning after a fight, but she breathed without struggle. If she didn't think about it, the mission, the meaning behind the mission, she'd be okay. And when it was over, she could go back to her old life, make a new life, find somewhere away from the Rebel Alliance, away from Saw Gerrera and Galen Erso, and
just don't think about it.
"Captain Andor!" a voice called. Cassian halted mid-stride beside Jin, glanced toward the hangar, and spotted the source of the yell. The rust-haired general from the bunker, who'd been all snide remarks and grunts instead of mute senility like his partner.
"General Draven,"
Cassian murmured.
"Give me a moment."
"No rush," Jin said.
Cassian dashed ahead to the boarding ramp of a battered U-wing transport, unslung the duffel he carried over his shoulder, then hurried back in Draven's direction. Jin followed his path to the ship, giving the vessel a cursory once-over. While the base as a whole was larger, busier, and better equipped than anything she'd seen from the Rebel Alliance before, the U-wing was in line with her expectations. Like the one that had retrieved her from Mobani, it looked like a set of engines with a cargo bay strapped to it, maintained and repaired over the years by a droid with pistons for hands. She'd been aboard worse.
"Jin Erso, alias Leanna Halleck, prisoner 6295 Alpha."
She flinched again at the sound of her name. She would have to get used to it. She looked up the boarding ramp to the main cabin. Towering above the communications console stood the security droid emblazoned with Imperial symbols that had captured her on Mobani.
"I'm K2SO,"
he went on, with a cheerfulness Jin could only interpret as threatening.
"I'm a reprogrammed Imperial droid."
"I remember you," she said. She'd heard stories about reprogrammed droids going wrong, about safeguards reasserting themselves, about old code suddenly resurfacing for reasons no one could explain. She wasn't overly concerned. If K2SO reverted to type, the ranking members of the Rebel Alliance would be his top priority. Jin, an escaped convict drafted into the mission, wouldn't be strangled until second or third, at least.
"I assume your presence indicates that you will be joining us on our trip to Jeddah,"
the droid went on. A statement, not a question.
"Apparently so."
"That is a bad idea." "I think so, and so does Cassian. What do I know? My specialty is just strategic analysis.
Jin was barely listening. She'd turned away from the droid, looking across the hangar to where Draven and Cassian huddled together. They stood too near each other, leaning in to avoid being overheard by passing pilots and technicians. To her surprise, Jin realized she trusted Draven. He was an ass, but that made him predictable. Cassian, the intelligence operative, the spy, the casual liar, could be trouble.
Can you tell what they're saying?
She asked K2SO with a glance over her shoulder.
Yes,
the droid said, and retreated to the cockpit. Fair enough, she thought. Left alone in the cabin, she took the opportunity to examine Cassian's duffel and its contents. Nothing but gear. Weapons and portable med packs and signal boosters. No hollow image of a dutiful wife or tattered childhood security blanket. He packed impersonal, and he packed light. Jin pulled out a blaster pistol, tested its heft and grip, and strapped it on her hip. The Blastech A-180 wasn't her weapon of choice, but it was sturdy and low profile. By the time Cassian had turned back to the U-Wing, Jin was moving to peer into the cockpit herself. The droid, adjusting one setting or another on the flight console, ignored her. She heard the exterior door shut and seal. You met K2? Cassian asked. Charming, Jin said. Cassian lifted his shoulders in a boyish, what-can-you-do shrug. He tends to say whatever comes into his circuits. It's a byproduct of the reprogram. The droid's vocabulator increased in volume, loud enough to hear in the cabin.
Why does she get a blaster, and I don't?
Jin kept her hand off her weapon, but shifted her weight into a defensive stance as Cassian shot her a look. I know how to use it, she said. That's what I'm afraid of, Cassian answered. Jin watched the humor, the warmth, evaporate in a flash. The expression of a calculating spy emerged. She felt a certain sour satisfaction.
Give it to me, he said.
We're going to Jeddah. That's a war zone. You want me to risk my life to help find Saw?
She shrugged.
Trust goes both ways.
Cassian stared a moment longer. The look of calculation, too, vanished. And Jin could no longer read him at all. He returned her shrug and hauled himself into the cockpit.
Off to a grand start,
Jin thought, and went to find a bunk, or at worst, a half-comfortable surface. She hadn't slept since Wobani, on the night her cellmate had promised to kill her.
You're letting her keep it? The blaster?
Cassian Andor pulled himself into the pilot seat of the U-Wing. Worn, thinly padded, stained by the sweat of a dozen species, and swept a hand over the controls, refamiliarizing himself as best he could. It had been a while since he'd flown a transport. K2 waited for a reply that didn't come, then asked,
Are you interested in the probability of her using it against you?
Humidity had fogged the cockpit viewport, rendering the jungle a green smear. Cassian sketched out a course in his head. Flight control recommended skirting the canopy briefly before attempting full ascent from the moon of Yavin 4. A half-hearted attempt at disguising Base 1's exact location from any Imperial probes.
It's high,
the droid said. Cassian shook his head. Let's get going.
It's very high.
You don't know the half of it,
Cassian nearly said. He thought back to his conversation with General Draven in the hangar. The assurances of trust, of confidence in Cassian's judgment, were swiftly being pulled into the amorphous eddies of his memory.
but Draven's orders were etched in steel. Galen Ursa is vital to the Empire's weapons program. There will be no extraction. You find him, you kill him. Then and there. Draven wasn't wrong to want Galen Ursa dead. It would be a righteous killing as well as a practical one. The execution of a man surely responsible for the deaths of countless civilians. Urso's years inside the Imperial War Machine could have no innocent outcome. If killing Urso saved a single life, then that was cause to celebrate. But if not, his assassination was no less justified. Nor did the contradiction between Mon Mothma's orders and those of General Draven trouble Cassian. The notion of bringing Galen Ursa to a Senate hearing, of exposing the Empire's planet killer, of creating such an uproar inside the civilian government that the Senate would move openly against the Galactic Emperor, was absurd on the face of it. Mothma desired a leveraged détente. A political solution made possible through rebel military action. That was, to Draven and Cassian, self-evidently impossible. The Imperial military was loyal to its commanders, and its commanders believed that they, rather than the Senate, already affected complete control over the Empire. They were right. No peaceful transfer of power could occur. Yet Mothma was an idealist. Cassian suspected she wanted a Senate hearing not because she thought it would work, but because she felt obligated to try. Cassian admired Mothma. Galen Erso's assassination would free her from the obligation of a doomed peace effort. And yet, Cassian was troubled nonetheless. He was escorting a girl not much older than a teenager to see the father she had believed she'd lost. A girl who, genetics notwithstanding, had clearly inherited Saw Gerrera's burning rage and icy competence. The need in her eyes frightened Cassian. Had the other seen it? Had he imagined it? He wasn't sure what troubled him more. What he was doing to Jyn Erso, or what she would do to him if she ever learned the truth. Chapter 3 Bodhi believed his suffering would end soon, that Saw Gerrera would hear him out and set him free. That the weeping sores on his feet would be treated, and his wrists would be unbound, and the coarse cloth hood torn from his face so that he could see and hear and breathe again. If he didn't believe these things, he knew he would go mad. He had marched with the rebels for most of the day, only sure of the passage of time by virtue of the sunlight that passed through the fabric of his hood. From the desert they'd entered a shelter of some kind, a building or a cave where the feeble warmth of the sun vanished. Now he knelt on a rough stone floor and waited. He heard bodies shuffle nearby, distant footsteps, voices in adjacent rooms. He didn't try to speak. His mouth was parched. These were not the rebels Galen Ursa had described. Gallant men and women whose righteous hearts led them to oppose the horrors Bodhi had seen, the deeds in which he'd been complicit. Instead, these were the rebels the Empire had always warned of. The murderers, the criminals and terrorists who concealed their viciousness in a patriotic wrapping. The ones who saw the deaths involved in spaceport bombings as a small cost for smaller victories. Saw Gerrera would be different, though. He had to be different. Lies! The hoarse, ghostly bellow echoed in the chamber. Along with the voice came a rhythmic, metallic clanking like the firing of a piston.
deceptions!
There was nothing but fury in the voice.
Let's see it!
A demand hissed from terrible depths.
Bodhi listened to more shuffling and scraping, craned his neck and strained to see something other than silhouettes and stitching.
Bodhi Rook, cargo pilot.
Hands suddenly grasped Bodhi and yanked him to his feet. He would have fallen if the hands hadn't clamped his shoulders.
Local boy,
the ghost scoffed.
Anything else?
There was this.
A second voice in another language. Bodhi recognized the speaker as the Tognath with the respirator.
A hollow chip. Unencrypted. It was found in his boot when he was captured.
Bodhi jerked forward in the hands that held him, not to escape, but to demand attention.
I can hear you! You made your point! I'm scared. You made me scared. But he didn't capture me. I came here myself.
He couldn't tell if they understood him through the cloth.
I defected!
He called around a mouthful of fabric.
I defected!
Lies,
the ghost repeated.
Every day, more lies.
Lies!
Bodhi was almost screaming now, violently sucking in breath through the sack to give his fury strength.
Would I risk everything for a lie? We don't have time for this! I have to speak to Sagarera before it's too!
Someone grabbed the sack and tugged, yanking the hood free and scraping the work goggles back on Bodhi's scalp.
Bodhi could see again. He almost wished he was still blind. He was in a room. Not a cave, but a chamber hewn from ancient stone and sparsely appointed as a living space. Three of his captors stood nearby while a fourth man, a stranger, stood before him. This man, the ghost, Bodhi assumed, the hoarse and chilling voice, had wild, graying hair and a face knotted with scars. He leaned on a thick metal-shod cane to support the weight his artificial leg could not.
Saw Guerrera?
Bodhi asked. This time no one snickered. Saw pinched a hollow chip between two fingers. Bodhi nodded toward it.
That's for you,
he said. He heard himself babbling, protesting, couldn't stop the flood of words.
And I gave it to them. They did not find it. I gave it to them.
Galen Erso, he told me to find you.
Saw Guerrera laid his cane aside and grasped an oxygen mask attached to his armored chest plate. Without looking from Bodhi, he brought the mask to his face, inhaled, and returned the mask to its place.
Please believe me,
Bodhi thought. Or maybe he said it aloud, he wasn't entirely sure.
I did this for you. I did this to do something right.
Saw turned his head to signal the Tognath.
Bor Gullet,
Saw said.
Bor Gullet?
Bodhi asked.
Then the cloth scraped over his forehead and nose and lips again, and arms dragged him backward, spun him away from Saw, away from the man he'd been sent to find, away from salvation and vindication and redemption.
Galen Erso sent me!
He cried through the sack.
He told me to find you!
He said it and things like it over and over. And it did him no good at all.
Orson Krennic, Advanced Weapons Research Director of the First Galactic Empire, had never received the respect he was due. This was not an accident of fate, nor a symptom of some personal weakness. While Krennic could acknowledge that he lacked the scientific prowess of a man like Galen Erso, even the most arrogant researchers under his command largely accepted that genius when bound to Krennic's vision, accomplished more than genius could alone. It was Krennic who, across two decades, had directed 1,000 brilliant minds